everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. We want to thank you all for joining us. And this is what we're going to be talking about.
APAC, I'm coming to tear your kingdom down.
That's a U.S. member of Congress. Israel takes her out, and now she vows to take them on. This is Direct Impact. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. Okay, I want to start today with a story that when I turned on the TV and watched this last night and started reading about what was developing, it seemed really, really ominous, right? On its face, really, really ominous. But the jury really is still out on just how significant this really is. I mean, all things considered. First of all, here it is. Members of the Ukrainian military have crossed into Russia and have attacked the border town of Sudzha. And they have destroyed buildings and killed at least 4 people, injured another 28. As usual, those numbers will obviously change. You see it right there with that little red orangey dot? That's the place we're talking about. It's a border town right there between Ukraine and Russia. As about 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers crossed over and conducted this incursion. Now, obviously, when you think about the idea that soldiers trained by our country, the United States of America, and using our weapons would invade Russia, that's kind of scary. Think of it this way. Imagine for a moment if Russia trained, equipped, and then supported 1,000, I don't know, Canadians and their soldiers to cross into Michigan or Minnesota and attack and kill people who are Americans in Minnesota or Michigan or Wisconsin or name your poison, right? How would we react to that? How would we feel as Americans about that? You don't have to answer because I know the answer. So far, though, here's the good news on this. Russia does not seem to be overreacting, and the attack is beginning to look, to me anyway, like it's a bit of a diversionary tactic. Maybe even a last gasp of a badly losing, beaten Ukrainian military in an attempt to get worldwide attention, which they've gotten, by the way. Everybody seems to be talking about it, as they certainly were last night. So, this is important. I just read this before going on the air and preparing this for you. A Zelensky government official has come out and essentially said that this was done to instill fear in Russians and possibly make them turn against their own government, which is fascinating, right? In fact, it seems to have, so far at least, the opposite effect. So there's also reporting that the town of Sudzha, the one I just told you about, once again, let's look at it, was picked because there's a pumping station there that delivers Russian natural gas to Europe via Ukraine. But from what we can tell so far, that does not appear to have been damaged. Now, what else? Okay, so Russian government officials immediately convened an emergency meeting of all those affected in the cursed region, that oblast is what they call it, which is really like a state or a province, what we call them over here in the West. They're giving each family that was affected by this millions of rubles so that they can relocate, because they're going to have to leave that area. They're beefing it up with security, from what we understand. Of the 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers who were told busted their way through the border into this Russian village, about 350 of them apparently have been killed.
We'll have to start with the events in the Kursk region. As you know, the Kyiv regime has undertaken another large-scale provocation and launched indiscriminate shelling of civilian buildings, residential houses, ambulances with different types of weapons, including missiles. Immediately after our meeting, I will have a meeting with the heads of security agencies, the Ministry of Defense, the General Staff, the FSB, the work of the Federal Security Service on the border. I will hear another report from my colleagues on what is happening in the Kursk region. But I would like to say that based on the results of my conversation with the acting governor of the Kursk region, instructions were given to several civilian departments to provide necessary assistance to residents of the region.
You know, as I'm watching that, I'm just thinking to myself, Manila, maybe it's me, but and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. I'm comparing that very matter-of-fact way in which this Russian group of people sit down and start dealing with this horrible issue And it doesn't look like they're grandstanding. They're not calling their oppositions communists or fascists. There's, it doesn't look like it's like overly staged. It's like we're just listening to people trying to deal with the situation at hand as best they can. No big blowhard statements. We're gonna attack and kill and do. It's so different, right? From, I mean, I'm trying not to judge here, but gosh, it's so different from what we're used to here, right?
Yeah, Rick, I think if we look back at all of the recent American presidents up until, let's say, going back to George W. Bush, even before that, actually, Bill Clinton, we've heard every president except for Joe Biden commonly say that they know of Vladimir Putin to be a very calm and measured and effective leader, and that he doesn't act in any bombastic ways. So I think that's more of what we're witnessing here. So even though this was clearly an escalation into their territory, into Russia proper, at the same time, the fact that Ukraine, as we know, is woefully low on bodies to throw at this war, losing 350 people at this, you know, effort by 1,000 men is a big deal for them. For Russia, you know, this kind of shows the territorial eyeballing, I would say, of Ukraine wanting to, as you said, get worldwide attention and perhaps expand the war by, you know, calling the friends in NATO, hey, look what we're doing over here. Yeah. Come help us over here, because it's the last gasp for air as this war drags on into its third year. They're running out of people, running out of time, and then they're playing against the clock with the U.S. election less than 100 days away.
Yeah, and you're playing with fire, too. I mean, look, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not an expert on, you know, Russo military affairs with Ukraine. I'm a journalist. I call him kind of as I see him. But you would think at some point you can only poke the bear so much. And at some point, with all these attacks that we've been seeing into Russia, at some point somebody over there might lose their patience, and maybe we'll just kind of leave it at that. By the way, here's another interesting. These two countries are very interesting in terms of comparison. The Nation of Israel, right? Their lobbying group, it's called AIPAC, has targeted and essentially removed several members of the U.S. Congress. It's just taken them out. They recently targeted and removed Jamal Bowman of New York. He's a Democrat. Then they took out a guy named Bob Good of Virginia. He's a Republican. They didn't like him. They didn't like his policies on Israel, so they just took him out. The latest to be targeted and replaced is Congresswoman Cori Bush for expressing sympathy for pro-Palestinian protesters. According to the New York Times, AIPAC spent $8 million on TV ads to taint her reputation, including ads about who she dated when she was a prosecutor.
AIPAC, I'm coming to tear your kingdom down.
Most people who get taken out by Israel's lobby don't do that, by the way. That was kind of interesting that she was doing that and she's made news. They replaced her, by the way, with someone who they recruited and who does support Israel, and they essentially paid for his campaign. By the way, what does the Biden administration have to say about all of this, right? It turns out they're angry at Bush for criticizing AIPAC. Now, you would think they would question interference in our elections, right? Haven't we heard that in the past? Nope. Here's Mr. Biden's spokesperson.
We're going to continue to condemn any type of political rhetoric in that way, in that vein. And so it is important to be mindful in what we say and how we say it. But we cannot have this type of inflammatory, divisive language in our political discourse.
That's interesting, right? So we can't have and shouldn't have that type of divisive language in our political discourse. Is that what I just heard her say? I think so. That's what, according to Pierre, Mr. Biden has told her that he wants, and that's why she made that statement. But I can't help now but wonder if he means language like the one that he used when he was asked about the president of China and the president of Russia.
Mr. President, after today, would you still refer to President Xi as a dictator? This is a term that you used earlier this year.
Well, look, he is. I mean, he's a dictator in the sense that he is a guy who runs a country that is a communist country that is based on a form of government totally different than ours.
Well, you have Ireland and Great Britain the Republic standing together against a murderous dictator, a pure thug who is waging an immoral war against the people of Ukraine.
Dictator, thug, murderer. I don't know. That sounds an awful lot like what I heard that young lady there at the White House briefing room say we should never engage in that kind of language. Didn't I just hear her say that? Am I crazy?
Well, Rick, it's not just the president himself, although I think at this point we're all kind of giving him a pass since he dropped out, because it's a tacit acknowledgement that we all know that he's been senile for quite a while. So who knows if that language he was using was intended to be so divisive or not? Maybe, maybe not. But we do know all the younger people that are surrounding him, all the younger people that are in Congress in both houses that are in his party, have continually used very inflammatory language, such as calling, President Trump a fascist dictator, calling Vladimir Putin also, calling him Hitler, calling Trump Hitler. This has been the mood of this administration, I would say, through and through and through. And this particular members of Congress at this point, they all use this sort of inflammatory language. So if Karine Jean-Pierre is going to wag her finger at any one person, she needs to wag it at herself as well, because we have seen her in press conference after press conference use the same kind of rhetoric. So I don't think it's right of her to condemn Cori Bush, who has just lost her seat and is now, I don't know how she's going to wage the war on AIPAC, but, you know, Karine, you got to look at yourself, girl.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the point that I'm trying to make is it's a double standard. Because you're not allowed to say, you can't use nasty language when you're talking about Israel. Oh, no, absolutely not. How dare you even criticize Israel? But when you're talking about specific countries that we've chosen not to like, you can say whatever the hell you want to say, and it can be as bombastic and as nasty and as insulting as you want it to be. So that's the real conflict here, which I think most Americans look at, and not just in Mr. Biden, by the way. It's all presidents. It's the entire Congress. Well, it's our entire media. It's our entire Senate. It's our entire system that does that. And we just have to say, what the hell country am I living in? Why does it not make any sense? What is this, a Fellini movie? Right? I mean,
Last thing, Rick.
Go ahead.
When it's here, when we're talking about AIPAC or Israel, it's kind of like the street equivalent of insulting someone's mama. That's just, you don't go there, apparently.
Yeah, so, I guess not.
That's what she's teaching us.
And I would only say to that, ain't my mama. Thank you, Manila. I appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dan McAdams. Now, this is a guy who understands the story that we are talking about. This is a guy who works for the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, with an emphasis on the word peace. Yeah, that's the word that we all used to know and revere back 20, 30, 40 years ago or something like that. We're going to be right back. Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. Thanks so much for being with us. I know there's millions of people, especially around the world, who like this show because of some of the conversations we have. I can't think of a better person to have a conversation with about some of these topics than Daniel McAdams. Daniel McAdams is He has an interesting view of our country, this country that we love, but he looks at it from the standpoint of the craziness in which much of our policy is conducted. And I guess we almost, Dan, have to start with that. The idea that we live during a time and in a country where some of the other countries around the world can come here and do pretty much whatever the hell they want. They can influence, they can interfere, they can choose our politicians, they can tell us what our foreign policy is, while other countries are not even allowed to have an opinion about what we do here. Isn't that bizarre?
Well, it's absolutely crazy. The entire country, for at least 4 years of the Trump administration, was absolutely paralyzed by the idea that Putin put Trump in power with zero evidence whatsoever. And as you were talking with my good friend Nil Chan earlier, other countries can come in and absolutely interfere in the elections to their benefit, and no one seemed to notice that it's happening. So you mentioned double standards. That's exactly what we're dealing here with, Rick. You know, and it's very ironic that the day after all of this about Cori Bush came out, taken down by AIPAC, $8 or $9 million spent on our campaign. Well, yesterday, another friend of mine, Scott Ritter, had the FBI show up into his house, ripped his house apart, saying, well, we're investigating the possible violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, against Scott, where you have an organization that should be registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, AIPAC, which doesn't have to. Nobody seems to care.
Well, and it's, by the way, you know, I've looked into this in the past, and it's not really just Israel, by the way. I mean, I read that the UK had interfered in our elections openly in the past. I can't recall right now. If you kill me, I can't tell you. I think it was during the Clinton administration or the Clinton election. And there are other countries who are our allies, so they're allowed. Obviously, nobody does it to the extent that Israel does. But we just look the other way if it's one of our so-called allies, right?
Yeah, Carter finances a lot of think tanks in D.C. that help create our foreign policy. There have been scandals about that in the past, and other wealthy countries or people with allegiances to foreign countries are very involved in our political process. You're absolutely right, Rick. It happens a lot. But I think the difference with AIPAC is that they openly brag about it. I mean, I'm watching on Twitter X after Cori Bush lost. By the way, she's nothing to write home about in terms of her intellect.
Yeah.
There was, however, another African-American woman who was very smart, and that's Cynthia McKinney, back when Dr. Paul was in Congress. She's a PhD, a very smart woman. She was run out of town on a rail by AIPAC, too. That's about 20 years ago, I guess it was. But nevertheless,
just to be clear for our viewers watching us around the world, in the United States, AIPAC doesn't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're brilliant or whether you're an idiot. They don't care. They care about one thing and one thing only. How do you feel about Israel? And if we like how you feel about Israel, you stay. If you don't, we're gonna take you out.
And they brag about it. You know, they had several things they put up on Twitter X after Bush was out saying 100% success rate. You know, we have a 100% success rate. You know, it's like the old Soviet elections, you know, where Comrade Brezhnev, he won by 100%. Amazing how that works, you know, and that's exactly how it is. But, you know, the one thing I think we can take from it, Rick, in a positive way is that the tide is turning. People are getting tired of this interference, and people aren't afraid to speak out about it. You know, there was a recent poll that came out of Chicago earlier this week showing that 56% of Americans, and that includes 53% of Republicans, oppose the U.S. getting militarily involved to the benefit of Israel. So the opinion has changed. The younger generation, the boomers are hanging on to it. The generation, the younger generation, generations after us, Rick, have a very different view. So I think they're trying to hold Loctite onto this, and they're not going to be able to for much longer.
You know, what's interesting here is we're not the only ones, by the way. Even some of this is taking place because this is not a Jewish American thing. It's not even a Jewish thing. This is not about a religion thing. This is about a foreign policy thing and how Israel is dictating foreign policy vis-a-vis through us with our weaponry. So here is a guy who's one of the biggest names in all of Israel. This guy used to be in charge of Israel's security. He was interviewed recently by CNN, and he blasted the Israeli government and said that they're essentially getting everything they deserve, including what happened to them on October 7th. Here, let's take a listen.
What should we learn after the 7th of October, which was probably the most horrible moment in our history? We should learn, first of all, that we shall not have security as long as we shall not end occupation. This is what Hamas told us. And we shall not have democracy as long as we shall not end the occupation.
Ami Ayalon with Shin Bet. And he's basically saying, well, you know, if you occupy people and treat them like crap for a long time, eventually those people are going to get mad and they're going to do something stupid. Then we're going to have to react to that thing that they do, and then they're going to react to what we do, and this can just go on for 100 years, or we can figure out how to make peaceful coexistence work. This is an Israeli guy, a guy who gets in the face of the Ben-Gaviers of the world saying this, and yet we can't say it over here. Which is fascinating and ironic.
I mean, The thing is, people will call you an anti-Semite if you're opposed to AIPAC's domination of politics and you're not a friend of Israel. Well, I think you're a better friend of Israel if you help Israel not do things that make the rest of the world hate them.
Right.
As what the former head of Shin Bet said, as what we would say, don't interfere in our elections. It irritates Americans. They don't like it. You're making enemies. I think you and I, Rick, are a lot better friends to Israel mm-hmm. than the people that are pushing them into a war that's going to get them annihilated with friends like these who needs enemies.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point you just raised. My biggest fear, because I've been to Israel, I love Israel. Israel has so many wonderful things about it. And obviously, every single one of us who grew up in the United States has somebody who we hang out with either as a kid or we grew up with or we go to their house and they come to our house who happens to be a Jewish American. So we all have this this intermingling with both the culture, the religion, and everything else. I would hate to think that my friends who are Jewish would be not able to travel the world because they will be seen as, I don't know, bullies, whatever, because of all the things that are taking place right now. I just can't see how if you were an Israeli citizen, you wouldn't be concerned about your children and your children's children and how difficult it's going to be for them in this world because of these things that are going on now, especially if it ends up in a massive war with Iran. I mean,
and the real sad part about this, Rick, is that, you know, for example, the protests on campuses in the U.S. against what's happening to Gazans, these are all being spearheaded by Jewish Americans. You know, Jewish progressives are at the forefront of the pro-peace movement when it comes to Gaza. And it upsets
Correct.
Me, obviously, because as you point out, the old cliche, I mean, very good friends of mine are involved with this. And they're all being tarred with the same brush. And you're whipping up an anti-Semitism that's not going to be discerning against the people who really are working for peace, the Jewish Americans working for peace, and those that are working for war. Very sad.
Down to a minute, but I want to just get your take on this thing that happened last night in this small town on the border with Russia, where it looks like Ukrainian, about 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers went up. What do you make of this, Dan?
Shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, you have Russia has air superiority. You come in there with 1,000, and from what I've heard, they're actually pretty well-trained troops. These aren't the guys they picked up off the street. Pretty well-trained troops that could be backing up some of your troops that are very thin in the front lines. Instead of that, you put them in an absolutely hopeless mission. Imagine, Rick, what this does to the morale of the rest of the Ukrainian army, which is being routed, across the front lines right now. It's an insane move. If you look at even the pro-Ukraine voices on Twitter, X, and elsewhere, rapidly pro-Ukraine voices, they have their hands in the air. What the heck are you guys doing? This is a stupid, insane move.
So you think it plays to Putin's advantage, interestingly, huh?
He can wipe them out. They're being wiped out. You can see video on Telegram and elsewhere. They're being wiped out like fish in a barrel. If you don't have air superiority, you can't move a line of tanks and personnel carrier in. But it's insane. You're asking to be killed.
I was thinking they did it because they just got the F-16s, which I'm not sure they know how to fly them. But, you know, they did get them. So they're thinking now they're going to have air superiority for some time. What do you make of that?
Well, I think they're looking to get a bargaining chip. Someone up there is doing too much funny stuff. Maybe it's Zelensky, but they think they're going to hold on to this area and somehow go to the table and say, okay, well, we want Crimea back. I mean, really? You guys need to lay off the powder or something. I don't know.
You mean exchange Crimea for Sudja, which is a town of about 40,000
exactly
people?
Here.
Yeah,
that
5,000 people. Sorry, I misspoke. Yeah, it's a tiny little village.
Deal.
That's amazing. Well, hey, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend. Say hi to the team. Always here for you. Thank you for sharing your insight, and we look forward to talking to you once again.
Thanks, Rick.
That's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box if you're looking for truths, as we like to say, because truths, man, they don't live in boxes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.